Welcome to York Hospital Radio Meets, a podcast from York Hospital Radio.
York Hospital Radio.
Welcome to the latest edition of YHR Meets. I'm Steve Eccles, and in this edition, I'm talking to David Kenworthy, former Chief Constable of North Yorkshire and now Chair of the Friends of St Monica's Hospital in Easingworld, and also a Deputy Lord Lieutenant of North Yorkshire. I hope you enjoy our chat, and if you'd like to make a contribution to York Hospital Radio, we'll tell you how you can do it at the end of this podcast. Good morning, David, and welcome to York Hospital Radio.
Morning, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. So let's just begin with a little bit about yourself. Where do you live and what family do you have?
Well, we live now in Easingworld. Having moved up here, we're sort of considered Southern Jessies, I think, because we moved up from Surrey via Surrey Police and Avon and Somerset Police and then up to North Yorkshire in 1998. So we've been here for some time now. And we liked Easingworld, so we stayed there.
So you've just about got your Yorkshire passport now, I would imagine.
Well, I don't think so.
So presumably it was the police that brought you up here in the first place.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, so the Chief Constable of North Yorkshire, or former Chief Constable of North Yorkshire. First of all, just tell me what the period was when you were performing that role, David.
1998 until the end of 2002.
So was that in the days before the Police and Crime Commissioners then? Was it a police committee then, or were you dealing with the Police and Crime Commissioners?
It was a police authority in those days.
Police authority.
Yeah. But funny enough, I had a sort of inkling that something like that was in the offing. I was asked if I would renew my contract, and I said no, I wouldn't. But one of the things was I could see that the policing was getting more and more political, and actually it's been borne out. If you look at what's happening here and compare it with what happens across in America, where you have elected police chiefs, you have elected judges, and all the rest, we're not far off that at the moment, and I find it quite worrying.
I mean, there was certainly a new political element added, wasn't there, with the creation of the commissioners' roles, for sure.
Well, they were supposed to be independent originally. That was the idea. But, of course, immediately each political party took them on and put their own candidates forward. So I don't think there are any independent police and crime commissioners anymore.
So I'm guessing you would think that you probably left the role at about the right time?
Oh, of course.
What does it mean to be Chief Constable? I mean, for example, how many people do you have working for you, and what exactly are the responsibilities of that role?
Well, North Yorkshire, and when I was there, we had about 2,500 people. Those were 1,650 police officers, and the rest were unsworn staff. The essence is that you come into a force like North Yorkshire, and you might not remember, but at the time, in 1998, there was a great scandal going on. The Sunday Times had done a great expose about initiation ceremonies at Harrogate Police Station. And there was, I mean, terrible trouble. The morale of the force was down. So the first job is actually to sort of find out what's going on and pick everybody's socks up for them. But then very quickly, you begin to get into the role. And of course, then there were some changes in the law at the time, which wanted crime and crime prevention to be dealt with a multi-agency approach, which meant police working with their local authorities, and therefore police boundaries being coterminous, and ours weren't. So, of course, I made myself popular by having a reorganisation, which is what every boss does coming in. But, of course, it wasn't well received by either the public or my own staff, so I had a great selling job. So I was a salesman to start off with.
And as a Chief Constable, do you, like you sometimes see on the television, I think, get involved in individual major cases, or are you more running the force as a whole?
When I see the television ones, sometimes many years ago there was a programme called The Chief, and there was one where there was a riot in a prison, and the Chief Constable was the first person through the door. At that stage, I switched off the television. It was just absolute rubbish. I mean, frankly, it's rather like, you know, if the Chief Constable's there in the lead, it's all going wrong. Because what you've got to do is actually get everybody else prepared. You've got to make sure they know their own roles. So we had an example of that in the floods in 2001 down at Selby, and in the Selby rail crash as well, where you have a tiered command structure of gold, silver and bronze. And actually, once everybody's doing their bit, I was a bit like young Mr. Grace in Are You Being Served? Just going around and saying to people, you're all doing very well.
Because, of course, you, are, as the Chief Constable, are the public face of the police force, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Were you doing news conferences and things like that? Was that part of the role then?
Yes, to a certain extent. But actually, the best people to talk about these things is the person who's in command. they know the story. They've got things to say. It's actually rather like when I first came to North Yorkshire, there was almost a sort of taboo on police officers talking to the press. Well, hold on a minute. In this digital age where you arrive at the scene of a crime or an incident and the next person's there with a digital camera, in those days before phones really got going, you can't just tell them to go away with their camera. You've actually got to say something. And actually what you can do is sell a fantastic story, because police constables have the most difficult job in the world, in my view, management job. And they are managers. They get to the scene of an incident. They've got all these people milling around who are looking for a leader. Up pops the leader in uniform. And you've got to actually get these people to do exactly what you want now without any argument. And that is jolly difficult. I had an easy job. I knew all my people, all their strengths and weaknesses, and we could talk about things. But police, for a police officer on the street, that's very difficult.
And just talking about police officers on the street, presumably that's how you started.
20 years in London.
And they met?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Oh,
yeah, so and 5 years in Chelsea, walking virtually every day. Didn't have cars in those days. So
no.
It was a luxury.
Wow. And kind of rose up through the ranks, as it were. I always imagine that being a chief executive of a big organisation or a chief constable, there's no break from it. It's a relentless 24/7 procedure, presumably.
Yeah.
Stressful?
Well, it's stressful at times, but by and large, it was very enjoyable. People in North Yorkshire wanted the police. It wasn't a confrontational relationship. So I spent a lot of time, as you said earlier on, you know, being a PR man for the force, really, and selling the force and thoroughly enjoying it. But you were on call and on show 24 hours a day. So occasionally when I was on call, there's always a chief officer, certainly in those days, who was on call at night because of firearms incidents. Because when the phone goes at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, putting it bluntly, they're phoning up because they want to shoot somebody. And they've got to have a plan, and you've got to agree the plan. Well, you get out at 3 o'clock in the morning, and somebody whose adrenaline is racing away is on the other end of the phone telling you all the details. So the first thing you say is, stop, phone me back in 2 minutes, so I can wake up. And then you start thinking about it. But that can be quite stressful. And then you lie awake afterwards and thinking, gosh, did I do that correctly or not?
I can totally relate to that, having managed press offices in the past for councils and things.
Yeah.
The first thing you have to do is stop, isn't it, and assess the situation before you rush into making potentially the wrong decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, in this case, it can be absolutely fatal all the way around, you know, if you get it wrong.
And how do you look back on that period then? Do you look back on the Chief Constable period with pleasure?
And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I loved it. And I knew that most days when I went to work, I was going to get a smile or a laugh, because you're dealing with people, and people are very funny. And for 36 years, I was paid to people watch. And it's just... is that fascinating? You know, just things that people do. And even if, you know, you're dealing with something a bit grim, well, you go away and something else will take over, and, you know, you have to get on with it.
And the million-dollar question, would you want to be in this social media age and everything else that's changed, would you want to do it all over again now?
Well, of course, when you come to it new, yes, you would, because you don't know any better. You know, I look back on my time, like any of us who have had a career, you think, well, it's not the same now as it was when we were working. Well, of course it isn't. You know, as you say, in this digital age, it's a very, very different job. And I think they have an extraordinarily difficult job. However, when you watch some of the television programmes of police officers being followed around the beat, they're dealing with exactly the same sort of stuff that I used to deal with. The same sort of people, probably less respect, but otherwise it's the same job.
Were you based in that magnificent old building at Newby Wisk then?
Yes, that horrendous old building.
I said that deliberately, yeah. I had a couple of meetings there and I remember thinking, this must be great to visit like I'm doing, but yeah. I don't think I'd want to work here.
Well, it was nice to work, but of course the maintenance and the costs and things of the place were terrible. It was a great one listed building. You were limited in what you could do with it. You know, the plumbing and things like that were just archaic. It was very nice, yes, you're right. And, you know, I had a very nice office, which was very nice, but not as a police headquarters.
And, of course, in the middle of nowhere, effectively, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, ideal for staff getting their public transport, not.
Not, yes, exactly. That's what always used to make me smile about it. Yeah. Is it North Allerton where they're based now?
Yeah, yes, it's a sort of office block, really, back in Iceland in North Allerton.
Moving seamlessly on then from the police, some really fascinating stuff there, thank you, David, to your current, well, one of your current roles. So you are a Deputy Lord Lieutenant of North Yorkshire.
Yeah.
Now, for people who would expect, like me, obviously, that you'd arrive on a horse this morning or something with, you know, spurs and jangling, in reality, what does the role involve?
Well, the Lord Lieutenant is the King's representative in the county. She, in the old days, I mean, originally, the Lord Lieutenant, of course, could summon a militia. That's sort of fallen by the wayside a bit these days. And it was, if you were to compare it also with the High Sheriff was the legal officer, top legal officer for the county. But the Lord Lieutenant was the King's, is and was the King's representative. And so she appoints deputy lieutenants to assist her. I don't know how many there are at the moment, probably between 35 and 40 of us. But it's spread all over the county. So it's actually quite a thin spread. And some can be more active than others. You know, people have got careers, so they can't just drop things. Fortunately, when you get to 75, which I have done, you have to stop, which is rather ironic that we stop when the man that we represent only just started. So the job involves doing royal visits and things like that. You know, it's the glamour side. But actually, the most important one is seeking out people who are worthy of nominations for honours or charities, for example, for the King's Award for Voluntary Services, or businesses that could get a King's Award as well. So you do a lot of legwork for that and paperwork and doing investigations for that. And also, when people are nominated for honours, then a deputy lieutenant will do some background checks just to make sure that everything's all right before they go back to the cabinet office. I get wheeled out occasionally to do medal presentations at police headquarters for long service medals.
Yes.
But even that's embarrassing now because all the people who are getting their long service medal joined long after I'd retired, which is a bit of a come down.
Yeah. I have to tell you at this point that in the last year, we've actually met and interviewed another Deputy Lord Lieutenant of North Yorkshire who was at the time the High Sheriff, as in Claire Granger.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
so we learned quite a little bit about this, I must admit, but it's a fascinating role.
When I do those medal presentations, I tell them that, you know, being representative of the King is great fun, but actually you're also representing the people of North Yorkshire, so it's an opportunity to thank, in this case, the police officers and the police staff for their work, and for the families as well, for supporting them. Because they can't do it without family and friends. I still do love chatting to the families and chatting to them, to the police staff as well.
I was actually going to ask you whether you're still keeping in touch with North Yorkshire Police, and obviously the answer to that is yes, then.
Well, I do through these award ceremonies. I don't, otherwise I don't. I mean, I think there's a mistake in the previous governor hanging around in any walk of life. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's that for 8 years I was chairman of UK Anti-Doping. You know, at the end of 8 years, it stops. Don't go back.
Tell us a bit about that. What does that involve then, or what did that involve?
You'll be aware that over the years there have been lots of scandals of drugs in athletics. You know, for example, East Germany had a state-sponsored scheme to dope their athletes to win medals. But in this country, until 2009, the anti-doping function was carried out by UK Sport, which, of course, UK Sport, on the one hand, is paying elite athletes to win medals, and on the other hand, is trying to stop them cheating. So there's a potential conflict of interest. The government at the time, or the sports minister at the time, would not set up a separate body, which was a recommendation from the World Anti-Doping Agency. And so I got involved in actually trying to make sure there was no conflict of interest. And the first thing I said to the minister was, you've got to have a separate organisation. For various reasons, it didn't happen. Change of minister, change of policy. And I thought, well, I've made such a song and dance about this, I'd better apply for the chairman's job. So I got the chairman's job, which is a bit of a shock. However, it was really interesting because you feel that you're helping people to achieve their best on a level playing field. Because otherwise, you have no idea what your competitors are doing or taking. It was quite a challenge all the time, but it was really good fun.
So do you have a sporting background yourself? Is that what led you into this?
I'd like to say I was a brilliant rugby player. I played rugby.
Possibly on a level playing field, who knows? Yeah. But yes, absolutely.
Oh, sometimes we were lucky it was a level playing
yes,
field.
Yes, I can well imagine, actually. I can well imagine. So obviously we are York Hospital Radio, and we cover the whole area of the York Health Trust. And as you know, when we're on radio as opposed to podcasting, we're on DAB, which almost goes out to Easing World. So you are the chair of the Friends of St Monica's Hospital.
That's right.
Now, people in the Easing World will be familiar with St Monica's Hospital, and if I'm honest, I know where it is, and I know where the building is, and I know it's small, and that's about as much as I know. So for those people who are listening now who are not familiar, tell us a bit about St Monica's Hospital.
It's a gem. It's a 12-bed unit, which is used largely for people coming into, let's say, from the main hospital, who are on their way home. Is a good stepping stone to get them ready for going living at home, independent living at home. Or the GPs will put people in there for respite care or just for recovery after an operation or whatever. I mean, there are a whole lot of things, but it's only a 12-bed unit. But there is also a physiotherapy unit attached to it. But however, that's probably going to stop being an active unit because there's a new health centre that's been refurbished in Easing World. So the physio is going to move down there. That's the sort of thing that it does. we as friends are probably more active than most other sort of groups of friends in the group, mainly because we've got quite a bit of money. And the reason is that we've been left legacies over the years. The friends have provided palliative care suite, a dining room and sunroom, a meeting room, the physiotherapy unit they paid for. And so a lot of facilities that the friends have built and paid for over the years. So it's a really good little hospital, but it was originally, it was in the 1870s that it was set up. So the building dates from then. And it, unfortunately, that's some of the restrictions that that imposes just because of the architecture. But they do extraordinarily well to work around that. And also with the new bits added on, it does work quite well.
Is it still a practical facility? I guess it does have its challenges then.
Yeah, it has its challenges. So, for example, we have a young nursing sister there who's in charge. She's really good news. And she can see, for example, that the nurse's station is too far removed from the patient. So there's a room that could perhaps be adapted. So we were sort of talking about that the other day. But the architecture and the building does restrict development, but not wholly. And there are things that can be done. We are guaranteed that the hospital will be there for some time in the future, because then we're willing to spend some money on it. So, for example, the windows need doing, really replacing, desperately need replacing. Until we get some guarantee, we can't really put money into that, but we want to.
Do you have to be from Easingworld or the Easingworld area to be a patient at St Monica's? Is that who it serves?
You don't have to be, but it generally is. It's the four GP practices that feed into the hospital. But also, there are some that come in from a bit wider away. But one of the problems, of course, if you bring people into there from further away, then visiting is difficult for relatives and things like that. So by and large, it tends to be local people.
So in this day and age of much larger hospitals and much larger facilities, why do you think that such a small hospital is still relevant and still important?
Well, I would say that it's brilliant because of the care that people get. It's almost one-to-one care. It's owned by Easingworld. Easingworld people feel very strongly about that hospital. And over the years, it's been downgraded. They used to do minor injuries, for example. I mean, when it first started, it was the hospital. And they would do all sorts of things, operations and all the rest of it there. But it still has a place, I think. And if you look at the health service is talking about these sorts of facilities to move people on. You know, you've got York Hospital must be full of a lot of people who can't get out for various reasons. Well, this offers a stepping stone, together with other work that's going on in the Easingworld, to get people back into home and back into the community.
At the back of my mind when I asked that question, I was kind of thinking, actually, I could see a scenario where it becomes even more important, potentially, yeah.
Yeah, it is. I think these places are vitally important. You know, if I think back to my childhood, we had the Cottage Hospital. I mean, I had my tonsils and adenoids out. Highlight of that was ice cream. I think that was all I was allowed to get ice cream. But, you know, the Cottage Hospital was always part of the community. We had another one when we lived down in near Bristol.
You've talked about the Friends as being fundraising. Is that the main role of the Friends of St Monica's on a day-to-day basis? Is that really why the Friends exist?
Well, originally, of course, it was. But we don't actually have to fundraise just at the moment because we have got quite a bit of money. So what we did about 5 years ago, there was a realisation that the money we got, we couldn't spend on the hospital. But, of course, the Charity Commission are very wary of charities sitting on a load of money and not doing anything with it. So the constitution was changed to allow us to make grants into the community to support health and well-being in the community. And so that takes up a large part of our time. The hospital is still number one, but doing the grants and assessing the grants, things like that, is the next most important bit.
So how do you go about promoting health and well-being in the wider community? What sort of things do you do?
Well, I suppose the first thing is that we don't actually promote it. What we do is make it known that we have the facility to fund worthwhile projects. So, for example, walking groups and walking therapy groups and things like that we've done. We work closely with the EDCA, the Easingworld District Community Care Association. We've realised, for example, during COVID, that EDCA has lots of volunteers, and at the time we didn't because they couldn't go into the hospital. And it seemed that there was a synergy in what they were doing and what we were attempting to do, because they're actually practically helping people in their homes. I mean, 35% of the population of Easingworld is over 65. So there's a lot of potential demand for services where people become frail and can't look after themselves to a certain extent. But during the pandemic, for example, we paid for all the meals for the volunteers and staff who were doing the vaccination clinics. And we insisted that the meals had to come from the local restaurants and pubs, and that they were to charge us full price. Because if you recall, their businesses were having a terrible problem at the time. So you support the local businesses by doing that sort of thing. But now we moved on. Edgar have a man in sheds facility down at the football club, and we support them. And in return, they mend garden furniture for us in the hospital. So it's a very good relationship, and there's more to come out of that.
I think you have a particular scheme for getting older people active again and looking after their health and well-being.
Yes, we have the frailty assessment, comprehensive geriatric assessment, which is a trial by John Morris, who's one of the GPs in Easingwold. And we're funding this for 2 years. The idea is that you deal with people who are potentially frail or getting frail and try to come up with a personalised care plan so that they can actually live independently for longer and therefore don't load up the health system. So each assessment of each person will take about 2 hours. It involves looking at medication, a GP looking at them, occupational therapy, looking at mental well-being, looking at their sensory perceptions, you know, is their hearing loss causing them problems or eyesight? And it's a really thorough check. And the idea is at the end of the day, to come up with this plan, individual plan for each person to help them to carry on independently for longer. Now, it's early days. We're just coming up to the end of the first year. They haven't seen as many people as they or we would have hoped, but that's probably about creating a demand. It's an unknown factor, but we're looking forward to seeing what the results are and whether there are actually any long-term results. Because if it does work, and there are other schemes, this is not just unique to Easingwold. There's one over in Hull. There's one up in the north of North Yorkshire somewhere. Our area is ideal because of the age profile, really, of the population. It's a bit like, go back to policing. You know, if you think the original police, their primary object was to prevent crime. Well, that's gone by the board, putting it bluntly. But with health, you've got to be preventive in all sorts of ways, because otherwise we cannot afford for people to be sick and run a health service like we do.
How do the Friends of St Monica's Hospital, how do you maintain your profile in Easingwold?
Well, we actually have a membership. Originally, the Friends were set up as a member organisation, running things like garden parties at the hospital and things like that. And the Friends are still there. We still have about 200 members. So they get a regular newsletter that I see you've got a copy there. They get the newsletter. The Easingwold Advertiser, the local newspaper, are always willing to put articles in there. And so we try and keep feeding them things in there. You don't want to overdo it, but you've got to keep a constant reminder, particularly as Easingwold has grown. You know, when we first moved there in 1998, the population was about 4,000. It's probably now about near 6,000. And those new estates, those new people, do they know about the hospital? You've got that. That's the thing that worries me about Easingwold, is all these people coming in. Do they know what we can offer in the town centre? So that's quite a hard sell to try and get people engaged with that. But of course, a cottage hospital, unless you're elderly or you've got a relative in there, you know, what does it mean for me? And that's actually quite a hard sell, but we've got to keep at it all the time. You know, you end up, when you walk into the hospital, by and large, they are all elderly. Whatever elderly means, I'm never sure of that. When I remember going to a police station, we had a scheme for crime prevention for the elderly. And I looked and I said, well, who's elderly? Of course, nobody can answer it. It's one of the nebulous terms that has no real meaning. Anyway, a lot of the patients are old and infirm in some way. The younger generation think, well, how does that relate to me? Well, when your granny or grandfather is in there, that's when you suddenly realise what a good service it is. It's sad that it gets to that stage before you actually realise you've got a little gem in your community.
And you talked about having, you're reasonably well off at the moment, the organisation. How do you actually raise funds then? What's your main methods?
Well, actually, at the moment, we get legacies. I mean, that's the main thing. We're very fortunate. We get legacies and people will go out and raise funds. And also, sadly, funeral collections where somebody's been in St Monica's, then the family, they're generally very grateful because they get such care. And the palliative care suite is a really nice room. It has, obviously, a bed for the patient, but it has a fold-out couch, which will turn into a bed for family who can stay there. So they've got a kitchenette. It's a very good facility, and families really appreciate that. And so we get collections made at funerals. It all keeps dripping in, but we are not hard fundraising at the moment. However, that could all change.
Who knows? Yes, exactly. Yes, we know the feeling here at York Hospital Radio only too well. I see from the newsletter from last summer that one of the organisations you helped raise funds for was a local cricket club. So it's a broad range of stuff that you're supporting, isn't it, really?
One of the things, when you start to make grants, I was, for my sins, was the first chair and sort of started the Two Ridings Community Foundation in North Yorkshire, having been involved with community foundations elsewhere. And I know from that experience that giving away money well is extremely difficult. And that's the first thing that a new charity like ours, giving away money, has to grapple with. And, you know, we've had some upsets as well, because you suddenly think, well, hang on a minute, that type of grant is not doing quite what we wanted it to. And some of the sports grants have caused a bit of a problem locally. But we gave the cricket club one because what they wanted to do was to put an artificial pitch down to attract young people in for longer periods than just the summer months. And it's been a huge success. I mean, the number of youngsters who are coming in there and therefore getting sport, which they might not be getting at school these days, is wonderful. And that sort of grant has actually paid an enormous benefit to the community.
And you can see how all this fits together, because clearly if the younger people are getting fit and doing sport, yep, rather than sitting at home on their phones all the time, yep, it should be a healthier lifestyle, .. which leads on to other things in the future, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's prevention, you bought it once again, and generating a healthy lifestyle for the next generations.
So if I gave you a crystal ball looking ahead to the next 5 years, for example, what would you like to see achieved by the Friends? What would you hope would happen?
One of the things that, not necessarily purely for the Friends, but there's always this question mark over a facility like St Monica's, like, will it be there in 5 years' time? The trust is under all sorts of pressures. You've only got to look at the newspaper every day. And where do they put their money? Now, if those beds, for example, are not fully occupied, they become very expensive because of the staffing issues. But also what is happening at the moment is, I mentioned earlier on that the physiotherapists are moving to another location in Easingwold, which leaves that site empty. Now, there is a demand for the renal unit, which is in Easingwold, is in what can only be described as a dilapidated building. It was a care home owned by North Yorkshire County Council, which they closed down. But because the renal unit was already there in a little wing of it, the health authority bought the premises and kept the renal unit going. In the meantime, the premises have degraded. I mean, they're in a terrible state. And our view is that, frankly, the trust would do better to sell that, to actually move the renal unit into what was the physiotherapy unit at St Monica's. It's a good site. It's got parking because, of course, the renal unit, people are coming in there to self-dialysize, and therefore it's almost a 24-hour operation. Well, in a place like St Monica's, you've got car parking. It doesn't impinge on the actual hospital itself, and it means there's a greater use of the site, which is to everybody's benefit. We'd like to see that happen. And that's one of the things that we're doing as the Friends, is to encourage the trust to look at that positively.
Let's see what the next few years hold then in that case. How do people find out more about the Friends of St Monica's? What's the best way to find out more information?
Well, the best way these days is on a website. It's fosmh.org.uk. For Friends of St Monica's Hospital.org.uk. We try and keep that up to date as we can with news, annual reports and things like that. But it's an interesting read.
Absolutely. I mean, the newsletter, as a York resident, as opposed to an Easingwold resident, I was given the July edition from last year. And it's an interesting read, actually. Yeah. There's a lot going on, isn't there?
Yeah,
definitely.
There is.
So I suppose to sort of wind up a little bit, David, how do you fit all this lot in and still have a family life as well and a life away from St Monica's?
Well, actually, I've trained myself quite easily. We have one of our daughter lives in New Zealand, so we have to disappear down the other side of the world every year.
Indeed, you've just been, haven't you?
Yeah, yes. Yes, we've just come back, which is very nice. And sadly, we get back here and it's very cold.
Yes, yes.
Retirement, you don't just stop, you change and you do different things, an opportunity to do different things. And, you know, here we're sitting here, we were all doing jobs, other different jobs a few years ago. And now we're doing this. You're engaged with the community. You're doing something useful. And it's fun. And I suppose it's a bit like gambling. You know, if the fun stops, stop. Well, if the fun stops, go off and do something else and have another go. Don't just sit and vegetate.
David Kenworthy, thank you very much for your time this morning. We've covered a lot of ground there. Quite fascinating stuff as well, everything from the police to being the King's representative to the Friends of St Monica's Hospital. Thank you for your time, and good luck for the Friends, the future, and indeed the future of the hospital, and for yourself.
Thank you, Steve.
My thanks to David Kenworthy and to my recording engineer, Keith. I very much hope you've enjoyed this edition of YHR Meets.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, then please consider making a donation to our charity via Just Giving, justgiving.com/York Hospital Radio. You can also help us by subscribing and writing a review to help spread the word. Thank you for listening to York Hospital Radio Meets.
Your station, York Hospital Radio.